Welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. I'm Sean Delaney and I'm glad you can join me today for our weekly mixture of chat and inspiration on the topic of teaching and learning. If you like what you hear, or if you're new to the programme and you'd like to listen back to any previous editions, you can download hundreds of previous podcasts by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the Podcasts tab. This week I'm bringing you another interview from this year's annual conference of the Computer Education Society of Ireland, CESI, which was held recently in Dublin City University. Adrienne Webb is the chairperson of CESI and she taught mathematics, geography and ICT for many years in St Michael's Holy Faith Secondary School in Finglas. She has a master's degree in digital learning. I was interested in finding out the influence that CESI had on the new Leaving Cert computer science programme. So when I spoke to Adrienne, I first asked her how CESI is working with the Department of Education and Skills in relation to introducing that programme into post-primary schools.
The department put this on a fast track and they had a development committee. And we're very fortunate in that one of our members from the CESI executive, John Hegarty, has been on that development committee with CESI hat. Now, there would be other people around who would know about CESI and would be aware of CESI. So we have been in there. We have been in those discussions. And then as we move forward with its introduction into schools, what we're seeking to do is we're seeking to see the Leaving Cert Computer Science as something that is for all of education and not just for Leaving Cert. So we thought that the whole area of computational thinking and that problem-solving approach was what should be done really from junior infants right the way through. So with that in mind and not looking at the Leaving Cert science, we applied for some funding from Google to develop communities of practice. And we did that in conjunction with Richard Millwood, who's on our executive as well. So for this year, what Richard has been doing is, in conjunction with the education centres, the Association of Directors of Education Centres, we chose six different centres and Richard has visited them three times or will have done so by the end of April with the intention of developing resources for people themselves to find within themselves resources and to start that network that we hope will continue into the future. So far they have been fairly well received. The numbers aren't big, but it's only a start at this stage. We'd also be aware that only 40 schools were accepted for the first phase and something like 120 schools applied. So there are schools there who are very interested and who possibly feel that why didn't they get on? Why aren't they one of those favoured schools? So we're looking at a bigger picture. And what we hope to do is within CESI itself to accommodate those whose main interest is the Leaving Cert Computer Science, but also the people who are involved in the short courses for Junior Cert, also those who have an interest in the introduction to the primary level of the coding within maths. Our concern is that the media tends to use the word coding, and computer science is way more than that. And in the popular mind, coding and computer science are synonymous, but that's why we've kind of opted really for the computational thinking, for that broader umbrella to take it into account.
And how would you frame the difference between coding and computer science?
Well, coding itself is just the lines of code that people are so familiar with when they see on that, you know, adventure movie and all this coding coming in. You know, the people who write it tend to be very nerdy and they're the anoraks, as it were. And, I mean, it's so ridiculous, beggars belief. Like, if you think about coding, I was at something recently and Morse code was put up as a coding. And I said, well, fair play, that is coding. And then I started thinking about actually a knitting pattern. If anybody who's unfamiliar with is presented with a knitting pattern, they wouldn't have a clue what it was about either. Yet if you follow those instructions, you end up with something. So coding itself is just one aspect of that whole area of computer science, which is a lot to do with problem solving, cooperative learning, analysis. And then the coding in many ways is the end result. I always feel somebody describing just within the last couple of hours that I'm old school computing or coding, because the last thing you went to was the computer. You do your problem solving away from it. There's nothing to do with it.
So in a computer science course then, whether it's for Leaving Cert or even at college level, what percentage is the coding and what percentage are the other parts?
The coding would be one element of it. I wouldn't know offhand the exact percentage parts of it, but it fits in, I suppose, maybe a quarter of it. It isn't the dominant thing, and I think it'll be interesting to see how many students opt for it. I mean, if you have the experiences in school already, like you might have with teachers who are involved in SESI or who are interested in technologies themselves, you possibly have done robotics, you have done way more than coding per se, and therefore will possibly see the broader picture. But if all you've seen are lines of code, I mean, why would I be doing that? That's a bit boring, you know. To me, it's that problem solving that I want to do something, so how am I going to get it done? And if it's in robotics, well, I like my robot to do such and such. Well, how do I do that? I have to problem solve, break it down, that whole idea of breaking something down into its component parts, and then writing the code that matches it. So the code is nearly the language in which you get your ideas across, in a sense.
And you've talked about the groups that you have in the different education centres. Are they the communities of practice?
They are what we hope will be the beginning of the communities of practice. It's only 6 education centres simply because we have one person on the road and that's all that we can actually get to. But we are in discussions with the education centres about how that might be progressed next year. Hopefully we'll try again for funding. But even if there isn't funding, that to develop that idea of learning from one another as teachers and developing our own practice and our own mental ability to actually do the things. And as we grow in confidence, then you become a better teacher in the classroom.
And are the groups made up of teachers or are there other people involved?
No, there are others. They have been quite diverse. I mean, we have primary school, secondary school, we have some percentage of third level, one or two parents, because the beauty of an education centre is it's open to anybody. It's open to anybody who's a parent, technically. So therefore, you can have anybody at it. And we have had people who are just interested. And the concept would be to develop the communities of practice locally so that people don't have to deal with distance, so that they can develop that reliance on those teachers in their area. And we're just providing a vehicle by which they get to know who the teachers are in the area and an opportunity and a focus to do something on a kind of maybe a few times a year and get together with it.
How often do they meet and what do you expect them to do when they meet?
When they meet, they, as I said, they have met 3 times or will have met 3 times by the end of April because you're looking at all the other demands on people's times. And basically they're self-led because there's a different experience and expertise within each group. And the idea would be to try to, through SESI, who would have a good network of people who are strong in the various areas, that they would might contribute some of their information. But then there's loads of people who aren't involved in SESI who are communicated with through the Education Centre mailing list, who may come along never having heard of SESI but quite happy to be part of this community of practice. So it's very much teachers on the ground helping themselves.
And there is one person going around and kind of being a common thread among all of the groups?
At the moment, yeah, that's Richard Millwood. And the plan is to have a one-day workshop somewhere around June, the end of May, early June, and have it open house for anybody who's interested or want to come along. That we've yet to have the chats about that. And then going forward for next year, if we're funding, then we possibly would have somebody, Richard, going around again and maybe hitting some other parts of the country. If we don't have funding, we have to see about how we'd look after that and move that forward.
And who's developing the curriculum that will be, or the syllabus that will be used for computer science in secondary schools?
Well, the NCCA has that developed. I mean, that does exist. The difficulty that will be seen is that some teachers may just expect a textbook to match what's in the stated syllabus. And this is more project driven. I mean, that is the essence of it. It is project driven. So that may be problematical for some people. And that's where the need to be able to talk and to share with other people comes in, because this won't be prescriptive.
Is that what the professional development then will be like for teachers who want to teach this syllabus?
Yeah, PDST will be running their first course, I think, now in April for the teachers who are on the pilot schools. And they will have different sessions throughout the coming 2 years for them. And presumably will continue with that CPD. And yes, it will be very much project. It won't be from the top of the classroom. It'll be very much get your hands dirty and looking at the different aspects of it. I mean, the whole idea of working together as students, the whole idea of teamwork will be important, of planning, and while it's laid out into four different parts, the idea was that all of them are going on at any one time, and that building, you have this building of knowledge, so that you end up in the final term, I think it is, with the actual projects have to be done. Another aspect of what SESI is involved in is that over the years, traditionally in education, we all tend to be very much ivory towers and nobody talks to anybody else or is limited because of the organisation that they're part of. So people are at meetings and saying, oh, we should be talking about this and we should be talking about that. So there, a couple of months ago, before Christmas, in fact, I put out some feelers to the various interested bodies to see would they be interested in just meeting and talking and see if we have a common area that we can work together on. So that rather than have a teacher going off to a whole load of different locations and having to spend a lot of time in multiple places to get their information, that we could have one sort of central portal. Or the analogy I used was a big train station where you look at all the menus are there and you just pick where you need to go. So we've had a second meeting on that and it's been fairly positively met. So we're kind of in a development stage of what that'll look like. So we haven't made any public statements about it as such, except to say that the meetings have happened, and I think that's terrific because these are meetings that we have had with the likes of the NCCA and PDST and Kamara, who are also involved in similar sort of work, and the JCT and one or two other bodies, just to see that we don't all replicate what the other is doing and that we can work cohesively together on something. And SESI is in the happy position that we have very few boundaries on what we do because of the nature of how we work. For the want of asking the question, can we do something together rather than each doing it separately?
And what can SESI do without duplicating the work that is being done by the NCCA or the PDST?
Well, I wouldn't say that we'd be doing anything in terms of duplication. We're just trying to pull together the various strands. Obviously, as a voluntary organisation, we're not in a position to offer our CPD in a professional manner. Ours is not exactly accidental, but it's informal. And it does happen, there's absolutely no doubt about that, and the list supports people, but it's very informal, it's quite fluid, so I can't guarantee next year that the same people will be around. So you have to have something that I believe is going to exist into the future, at least for 5 years anyway.
And be sustainable.
And be sustainable going forward.
And from your experience of working with SESI over the years, what do you think are the needs that teachers have in terms of professional development in order to be able to deliver the syllabus in schools?
Confidence, their own knowledge. Nobody has been through one of these courses themselves before. It's unknown territory. So therefore, people are anxious to learn, to see what exactly is expected of them and to be able to confidently deliver it to their students. It's a learning curve for everybody, I would suggest, because one of the difficulties is that traditionally teachers who had a computer qualification as a degree were not registered with the teaching council because computing science wasn't a teaching subject.
And can they now register?
That is being worked out at the moment. But that was one of the things. So if you have a new teacher coming into education, what do they do? You know, if you're a teacher who's already registered, well, they can teach anything effectively because their registration is there, although strictly speaking, they should be teaching their subjects. But they can be asked to teach anything. And if they've been just taking on courses during the years, they've been very well, maybe very well positioned to do it. But if monetary gain was your motivation, then you have a computer science degree. Teaching is not the place you're going to go. So that is another issue that arises. It's not the logical choice for people who have given their time to do that qualification.
And another matter that typically comes up when a new subject is introduced is the whole area of resources. What kind of resources are schools going to need to implement this syllabus?
Well, the teacher will be the critical resource, I would suggest, and they need to be supported in what they do. It isn't really about terribly fancy equipment. There is funding, obviously, in the schools at the moment, and really the response of the teacher will dictate what sort of technology they would actually, what way they'll go with it, because there will be that freedom, which is nice to see. I think the biggest thing is that within the vision of the school itself, it must have sorted out in its own head where it fits into the other curricular subjects and that it is just one aspect of the technology that's done in the school, because that is what it is. It will just be one aspect of how technology is used.
I think a lot of people would be surprised to hear you saying that there's no fancy technology required, because technology seems so central to computer science.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, a computer works the same way today as the version that they produced yesterday, you know. And in fact, one of our members has taken some of the cars, motorized cars that you can pick in any toy shop, and is dismembering them to reconstruct them in terms of the robotics. So it's about what you want to do with it. And the micro bit has proven that you can do an awful lot with very little and with very inexpensive equipment. Like, you have the micro bit, you have the Arduino, you have the Raspberry Pi. They've revolutionized really the whole act of teaching coding, when you're looking at the coding and the problem solving. And they've introduced imagination in a great way, and it's very tactile and it's very immediate.
Can you say a little bit about what they are? Say, take the Raspberry Pi, or take any of them, and just say a little bit about how they might be used in school.
Okay, Raspberry Pi basically is the guts of a computer. It was produced in Cambridge originally, I think it was Cambridge, because they were concerned that the number of students coming into their computer science courses had dropped. So they manufactured 10,000 of these, I think, initially to disperse among the local schools. And they got such a massive demand from them that they've just kind of escalated out of all proportion. Effectively, it's only the size of a matchbox, but it will have your USB, it'll have your CPU, and you can program this little kit that costs maybe 10 or 15 euro. The micro bit was something that the BBC produced, again, with its concern around coding and students not being engaged with the whole area of coding, yet the world they live in is completely computerized, so it's kind of it's like you need to know what's going on. And they retail very low price as well. It's a little bit different to the Raspberry Pi in that there's an immediacy about it. You have your lights on it and you can see stuff a lot quicker in some senses. Then it's limited in other ways, but certainly the basic principles. A student or a teacher can do something and see the immediate effect, which is great.
So can we expect to see students doing things like designing apps and things like that in the future, or do you think it'll be different?
I think apps will be part of it, but I think you'll also be looking at the use of data, and data analytics will be in there as well, because that is very much a part of the world that we live in, and I don't think it's an area that people really fully understand how much data is collected through just pressing a button or accepting something. And the analytics of that is also forms part of the Leaving Cert programme. I think it'll go a lot into the area of robotics. I mean, artificial intelligence is obviously the big thing. That's the buzzword at the moment. That's a lot further down the road, but you can do that at a very simple level. And I think it'll be an introduction to the breadth of the field that is computer science will be important.
So what might happen in artificial intelligence?
That's the big question, isn't it?
Well, even school level.
In school level. Well, I suppose an exploration of what it actually means. And basically, if it's a logical step, how far that logic goes, and then what is the difference between a logical set of commands and moving to an artificial intelligence scenario where you're talking about, as a result of things that are done, new knowledge is created within the computer itself, or a new ability to deal with problems. And to understand how that is operating, how it might be used in different ways. I think it's a big area we're moving into at the moment.
And do we know much about the assessment of the new computer science syllabus at Leaving Cert level?
Yeah, we do. It's going to be 70%, if I have this right, it's 70% written paper and 30% will be the project based. So that's the way it's broken down at the moment. Obviously, we'd be happier to see it the other way around. But that's the way it is, and to get it that far, maybe it'll get pushed to 50-50, and maybe as time goes on. But I think as general assessment begins to change, then it'll be in the mix too for the change.
And the students then who do this course and are successful in it, how will they be better educated than students who haven't done the course?
Well, I think that should operate at a few different levels. I think they should have a better understanding of the role of technology within the world around them, from an understanding of it, not just, oh, this is what it does, but understand how and why. They should be better, I would hope, at the whole area of problem solving and of breaking things down into discrete parts, into the elements of a solution. The area of analytics that I would think that they would hope that and hope that the whole idea of data and what it can be, how it can be positively used in so many ways will be there as well. In terms of whether or not any of them would go on to do a course, a third level, which of course is the next question, well, does everybody who study physics go on to do physics? And does everybody who do biology or music go on to be musicians or biologists? It's part of education, and I hope and I think it'll appeal to certain students who have a particular bent, as it were.
And will inspire some to do great things.
Yeah, oh, without a shadow of a doubt. And I think, as we have seen so often in the past, that they may even be entrepreneurs before they actually leave school and won't be going to any third level college whatsoever because they'll already have the first million made.
wouldn't be the first time.
No. And that is an aspect of it too. I think it's certainly one of the areas where your students outstrip the teacher fairly fast. And it's the ability to handle and manage that in a way that allows for the development and growth of both the student and the teacher that's important.
Adrian, how did you get into this whole area yourself of computers?
I did my first computing when I was in college when it was punch cards and the LGs and UCD, and it just always took my fancy. I always liked it.
What were you studying in UCD?
Maths and geography. We had our first computer at home. My parents bought me a Dragon in the early 80s. And I just liked it. I liked the programming end of it. I liked the problem solving. You know, I liked taking a piece of paper and saying, right, you want this to happen, and then figuring out how it should be done. And when we had computers in my own school, I introduced them in 1984, which was kind of fairly early. And we were teaching programming up until the early 90s as part of the maths program with students. And it just developed. It just seemed a natural thing to do. When I started my teaching career, one nun said to me, she said, it's either computers or religion. They're the two things that you should get, that you have a choice with being involved in. I picked computers.
and
so I've been SESI since the early noughties.
How do you find SESI?
It's funny. Somebody asked me today, you're still involved in it. How come you're involved for so long? And the answer I gave is, I've met wonderful people. I have really met fantastic people who have no agendas. They're just interested in technologies and education for students, for improving things. And it's just so purist. I love it. My educators are the teachers around me, the people I meet at meetings, the chance conversations I have. You spoke to Joanna earlier on, and we met her in London. And you meet people who have different ways of interpreting what you thought was something fairly set and couldn't be interpreted in other ways, and it just opens your own mind. And that's where I've done most of my learning, an awful lot of them.
And your subjects were maths and geography. Mm-hmm. And so how much work do you do in computers now, or did you do when you were teaching?
You see, that's where it comes back to the school you're in and the equipment you have. So my philosophy was always, any innovation that I brought into school, it should be for everybody. There is a tendency to have within schools the person who is the ICT person, and if they go, everything is gone. What I always aim to do is to have school-wide innovation, so that it became an expectation within school that students would get to use the computer room in an effective way, that it wasn't only the transitioners got in there or only somebody else got in there, and to support the teachers going forward too. And what I would have loved in an ideal world was to have had a year in school, not in classrooms, but supporting teachers when they'd want to be innovative or they want to introduce something, because the teacher has to still teach the class. The content has still got to be gone through. So they can't spend a half an hour fiddling around with a machine that's not behaving or something that's going wrong. And I always felt that there was a role there that I would have liked to try anyway for a year, to support people making their innovation.
At a technical level?
At both. I'd have a degree of technical expertise, but it would be more in the thinking about it and thinking about what and why and how does this best work. And being happy to, you know, to stand there, that if it's the technical issues that's bogging you down, well, it's probably straightforward and we can do that, and then help you in the preparation beforehand. And if you want me in, you want me in. If you don't, you don't. But I think that idea of support when you're doing something new, when you've done your work at home, everything was working perfectly at home on your computer, you go into school and you do it, and you discover that the school's broadband blocks the one site that you want to use, and you never thought that that might be an issue. You know, those sorts of things, to have point them out. I think going forward, though, one of the big things for schools is they need a tech support. They need somebody to be running the technology, because it's ridiculous that schools are dependent on a teacher after school repairing or somebody coming in once a week. Students need it now. If you're going to do it properly, do it now.
Almost like somebody based in your local education centre, would it be, that you could call on?
Yeah, it could be somebody within a cluster. I know there was a model being looked at of having a cluster of 3 or 4 schools, and they would have a technical person who would go between them and help them out. Because let's face it, if you're in an office and your computer goes down, you stop working and you ring somebody and they come up and they fix it, the school should be the same, because the problem is in second level that you're on 40-minute classes. 40 minutes is gone. You know, what do you do?
You never get that back.
No.
You had a dragon in the early 80s. So over the last 35 years, what has excited you most about the developments that you've seen since that dragon computer in the early 80s?
Well, the dragon in the early 80s was you had to program. That was the only way you could get anything to do it. So when we came to the 90s and we were moving into the personal computers where the software was responsive to you, one of the things I always thought was most innovative was the digital camera. I thought it was one of those things that allowed teachers in the classroom to do so much in terms, and was used so imaginatively, that for a small piece of kit, it was disproportionate in what it could do. I know everybody went mad for the interactive whiteboards at one stage, and whereas I did like them, there's no doubt about that. The learning curve was quite steep, and they were costly, and they were tied to one room, so that kind of made it a bit difficult. I introduced a set of Chromebooks into school shortly before I finished, and they were great because we had a mobile unit, we wheeled it around. Big pluses, there were 7 seconds to log onto the web. It became realistic that you would have it on the desk. The students might only refer to it 5 minutes of being in class, maybe 10 minutes somewhere else, as against bringing everybody to the computer room, so that whole class there must be dedicated to use of the computer. They became the tool that I think that they should be, so I really like that.
And that praise for Chromebooks from Adrian Webb brings this week's Inside Education to a close. Thanks to Adrian, the chairperson of SESI, for her time and hospitality. I'll be back next week, but if you can't wait till then, you can find over 300 previous Inside Education podcasts at seandelaney.com. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from good bookshops and online bookstores. For now, from me, Sean Delaney, goodbye. Thank you for listening.